Hello and welcome. I'm Dr. Nicolas Villain from Paris, France. So please excuse my French. And on behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome you and thank you for joining us today's CMEO briefcase titled ARIA Alert, Timely Recognition in the Emergency Department. This activity is supported by an educational grant from Lilly. So I am Nicolas Villain, MD PhD. I'm an associate professor of neurology at Sorbonne University. I also work as an attending physician at the Institute of Memory and Alzheimer's Disease within the Department of Neurology at the Pitié-Salpêtrière Hospital in Paris. And so today we will focus on ARIA within the perspective of an emergency department. So for our colleagues from the ER, you will mostly see them as an emergency situation. So we will mention and focus on the severe ARIA. But for those who are not practicing medicine within a ER and ED, you can see, of course, this patient, they will present, since most of ARIA are asymptomatic or mild ARIA, you can see them in your outpatient facility or whatever. But this will not be the focus of our talk today. We'll mostly focus on ARIA within the context of an emergency department, so we will mostly focus on the serious ARIA. And I am delighted to be joined today by my distinguished colleague, Dr. Anna Franceschi. Anna, please introduce yourself.
Thank you for that, Nicolas. So I am Dr. Anna Franceschi. I'm an associate professor of radiology at Northwell in New York City, and I run the brain PET and PET MRI service for our health system, which is actually the largest healthcare system in the New York City metro area. So we are expecting to see a lot of these patients coming through both in the outpatient setting, but also possibly through the ER as well. As part of this presentation, I will be discussing with you the key MRI findings, as well as the MRI sequences that are used for the detection of ARIA. And I will also highlight the importance of utilizing an MRI scanner for the assessment of these patients in the emergency room setting. Although resources may be limited, this presentation will highlight the necessity of the use of MRI, including in the emergency room setting.
So our learning objective today is to differentiate ARIA from other conditions with similar presentation in emergency care settings. So we will first get started with an audience response question. Thank you for your responses. We will keep going and start with this introduction on amyloid targeting treatments. So what is an amyloid targeting treatment? It's an immunotherapy, it's an antibody, a passive immunotherapy, an antibody that is delivered IV, and that targets A beta. A beta is a small peptide that aggregates within the brain in Alzheimer's disease, and it starts from a soluble form that is then tendency to aggregate first from monomers to oligomers to protofibrils to fibrils and then to plaques. And different antibodies that target A beta have different epitopes, so they target the peptide at different location, but beyond the epitope location, it's also the aggregated form of the A beta peptide that is different from one treatment to another. For example, the treatment that has now received an FDA approval in Alzheimer's disease, lecanemab, targets protofibrils, whereas donanemab, that for which the FDA is currently examining the file for an approval or not, targets more specifically the plaques, because it targets a pyroglutaminated form of the A beta peptide that is only seen in plaques. So we have different selectivity, but their mechanism of action is clearance of aggregated amyloid, as we can see on amyloid PET. So that is a short description of amyloid targeting therapies. I will now turn it over to Dr. Franceschi to introduce us to our patient case.
Thank you, Nicola, for that. So let's meet our patient, Jacqueline. Jacqueline is a 60-year-old female who presented to the emergency department with her partner at 12:45 a.m. Her chief complaints included headache, some nausea, and the partner reported that the patient has been more confused and has not been able to complete normal daily activities. Her past medical history includes Alzheimer's disease, dyslipidemia, and depression. It's important to note that Jacqueline started an anti-amyloid targeting treatment 6 weeks ago for early AD, and her genetic testing had revealed that she's a carrier of the apolipoprotein E4. She denies any sudden numbness, weakness, or trouble speaking. So we can now briefly discuss the proposed pathophysiology of ARIA. When monoclonal antibodies targeting beta amyloid are introduced into the system, they bind to the amyloid beta in both the brain parenchyma, but also in the vasculature. As the amyloid beta is cleared, this leads to loss of vessel wall integrity, and these vessels may leak proteinaceous material, which leads to ARIA-E, meaning the edema subtype, or they can leak heme material, leading to ARIA-H, or the hemorrhagic subtype. So pivoting back to our patient, Jacqueline, when we think about potentially suspicious symptoms, such as her headache, confusion, and the inability to complete her usual daily activities, we have to consider, might this be related to her use of anti-amyloid targeting therapeutics? In terms of ARIA symptoms, it's very important to note that most cases of ARIA are actually asymptomatic, up to 74%. And when patients do present with symptoms, these symptoms are really very nonspecific. The most common symptoms include headache, confusion or altered mental status, dizziness, and nausea, vomiting. They can also include visual disturbances, acute subacute onset of focal neurologic deficits, gait disturbance, and seizures. So let's discuss a little bit the amyloid beta related cerebropathologies. First, we can talk about Alzheimer's disease. And really what happens in the setting of Alzheimer's disease, we have amyloid deposits in the cerebral cortex. These are primarily mediated by the amyloid beta 42 peptide, and these lead to Alzheimer's disease. Conversely, we can also have the accumulation of amyloid in the blood vessels in the brain. These are primarily mediated by the amyloid beta 40 peptide, and this leads to CAA or cerebral amyloid angiopathy. Here we have an imaging example of an amyloid PET MRI scan. On the left-hand side, we have a 3D T1 MP RAGE. We can appreciate biparietal atrophy that is more pronounced on the left side. In the middle, we have a amyloid PET, and we can see the loss of the normal expected gray-white differentiation. So this is a positive amyloid PET scan. And on the right-hand side, we have a fusion image. We can now go back to our patient case and discuss Jacqueline's findings. She had a baseline MRI at the time of the start of treatment, and now we are looking at her MRIs at 48 weeks following the initiation of anti-amyloid therapy. And we can see that on the flare sequences at 48 weeks, she has developed T2 flare signal abnormalities with associated gyral swelling in the left occipital lobe and also in the right frontal lobe. And you can see that highlighted with the yellow circle. We also have here the ADC maps, which are very important to highlight that there was no restricted diffusion that might suggest cytotoxic edema or an acute infarct. So effectively with the ADC maps, we are excluding an acute infarct as the cause of her symptoms. So now, based on what we know so far, do we have enough information to classify what type of ARIA our patient may have? Please put your responses in, and we will discuss later. Let's discuss now the role of MR imaging for ARIA detection. All of the clinical trial protocols of anti-amyloid targeting therapies included regular and frequent MRI monitoring for the development of ARIA. As we already mentioned, ARIA is most often symptomatic in over 70% of patients, but it is critical to identify and manage ARIA appropriately as it can be symptomatic, severe, and even deadly. Now, just to discuss the radiological classification of ARIA, both its type and its severity. So as we already said, we divide ARIA into two subtypes, ARIA-E or edema, that on MRI presents with T2 flare hyperintensity and gyral swelling. And ARIA-E can be classified into mild, moderate, and severe. Mild ARIA-E are flare signal abnormalities that are less than 5 centimeters at one site. Moderate ARIA-E is flare hypertensive signal abnormalities measuring 5 to 10 centimeters at one site or less than 10 centimeters at multiple sites, and severe ARIA-E is greater than 10 centimeters in one or more separate sites. Now, ARIA-E, or hemorrhages, is divided into microhemorrhages and superficial siderosis. So when we discuss ARIA-H microhemorrhages, mild ARIA-H is 1 to 4 new microhemorrhages, moderate ARIA-H is 5 to 9 new microhemorrhages, and severe ARIA-H is greater than 10 microhemorrhages. As far as superficial siderosis, mild ARIA-H is one new area of superficial siderosis, moderate is two new areas of focal superficial siderosis, and severe ARIA-H is three or more focal areas of superficial siderosis. So now, as far as management guidance from the lecanemab prescribing information, in terms of clinical severity, if patients are asymptomatic, they may continue on their therapies if the severity of ARIA-E is mild on the MRI, but we suspend dosing for both moderate and severe ARIA-E on MRI. If clinical symptoms are mild, we may again continue dosing based on clinical judgment in the case of mild ARIA-E, but we suspend doses in cases of either moderate or severe ARIA-E. And finally, if the clinical symptoms are moderate or severe, we will suspend dosing in cases of both mild, moderate, and severe radiographic ARIA-E. In terms of ARIA-H presenting on MRI, if the patient is clinically asymptomatic, we can continue dosing in the setting of mild ARIA-H, but we suspend dosing in the setting of moderate or severe ARIA-H. And conversely, if the patient is symptomatic clinically, we suspend dosing in cases of both mild, moderate, and severe ARIA-H. So now let's revisit the question that we asked a few moments ago. Let's discuss what type of ARIA does the patient Jacqueline have. So in this question, the correct answer is C. The patient has ARIA-E, which is moderate severity on MRI, and demonstrating moderate symptoms. So if you recall, on the MRI scan, she had developed two new regions in the left occipital and right frontal lobe of flare hypertensive signal abnormality that she did not have on her baseline scan, and she was also clinically symptomatic. Now, Dr. Villain, will you tell us a little bit about the risk factors for ARIA?
Absolutely. So risk factors for ARIA have mostly been studied within randomized clinical trials. That's one thing to know, because in every trials, there are exclusion criteria. So not everything is known at the moment regarding the risk factors of ARIA. Mostly, most data come from these trials with some biases as exclusion criteria I've just mentioned. So what are the main risk factors for ARIA? Of course, there is this apolipoprotein E status, especially regarding the epsilon 4 allele that is also known as a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. At the same time, it's also a risk factor for ARIA. And there is a dose effect, which is the homozygous carriers of the epsilon 4 allele have more risk than the heterozygous carrier of the epsilon 4 allele. That's the first one. The other one is also the baseline microbleed number that is a predictor of the subsequent ARIA. And that's why in most of this clinical trial, the drug has been contraindicated or excluded, individuals were excluded if they had at least 5 microbleeds, for example. Other factors are dependent of the antibody itself. We have few data at the moment, but we know that a few antibodies that have not been FDA approved, like other drugs like solanezumab, never induce ARIA, but they never work as well. So we may have some antibody differences here, and that's what we know at the moment. So we have to, of course, monitor if we can the apolipoprotein E epsilon 4 status in our patients, and inform them in a shared decision-making process regarding the risk and the benefit of a drug according to the apolipoprotein E4 status.
So let's talk now about some potential pitfalls on MRI imaging. So in terms of ARIA-H and potential mimics, we typically use the GRE sequence or the related SWI and SWAN to assess for ARIA-H. And as you can see here in the top right, we have a prominent area of susceptibility artifact at the interface of the temporal bone. And there are similar regions elsewhere in the brain when we can have susceptibility artifact that may mimic ARIA-H. Additionally, there is also the propensity to develop artifact in the phase encoding direction in the region of the torcula, as you can see in the bottom row of images highlighted by the purple arrows, and this can mimic both siderosis or microhemorrhages. Now, in terms of MRI imaging for ARIA-E and potential pitfalls, as we already discussed, we typically use the T2 flare sequence, either 2D or 3D, to assess for ARIA-E. And there are some artifacts, including, for example, incomplete CSF suppression that can lead to findings on MRI mimicking ARIA-E. It's important to note that superior CSF suppression is offered by the non-selective inversion pulse of a 3D flare, which makes it the preferred sequence for assessing ARIA-E, although it's a question of whether this is realistic in the clinical setting. Similar MRI findings may be seen with PRESS, evolving subacute ischemia, and inflammatory cerebral amyloid angiopathy. For both ARIA-E and ARIA-H, the history of monoclonal antibody therapy is crucial and will help lead us to the right diagnosis. There are some other pitfalls which are related to the scan technique, and I cannot emphasize enough how important consistency is. Consistency in the selection of the field strength, so 1.5 or 3T, consistency in terms of the specific scanner vendor, and then specificity in terms of the sequences and the sequence parameters that are used. So here we have a couple of images from the same patient that was imaged on different scanners. And if you, for example, focus on the GRE images in the top row at 6 months, you can see right away that it seems like these are two different patients with varying amounts of microhemorrhage on the sequence. But in fact, it is the same patient just scanned on a different scanner. So it's important to keep in mind that variations in surveillance scan protocols make it difficult to assess appropriately for interval development of microbleeds and siderosis, and can also change the appearance of flare hyperintense signal abnormalities. So let's discuss some key phase 3 clinical trials of amyloid targeting therapies that have been completed over recent years. So let's now focus on the incidence of ARIA in these phase 3 clinical trials. So in EMERGE and ENGAGE, which were clinical trials of aducanumab, the incidence of ARIA-E varied from 26 to 36%, depending on the dose of the therapeutic, and patients at higher doses had higher doses of ARIA-E, which were at around 35%. In terms of ARIA-H in the EMERGE and ENGAGE trials, these varied from 16 to 20%, and similarly, there were higher incidences on the higher dose of the therapeutic at around 20%. When we look at the phase 3 trials of lecanemab, the incidence of ARIA-E was 13%, and the incidence of ARIA-H was 17%. And finally, when we take a look at the Trailblazer ALS2 trial of donanemab, the incidence of ARIA-E was 24%, and the incidence of ARIA-H was 30%. So I think the takeaway home point of this slide is that across all these trials, approximately 30% of patients developed either ARIA-E or ARIA-H or both. So when you think about it, one of three patients that are going to be on these drugs will eventually develop some form of ARIA, whether it be asymptomatic or symptomatic. So Dr. Villain, what can this tell our emergency medicine clinicians about the likelihood of seeing ARIA in practice if increasing numbers of patients are prescribed these therapies?
Well, it will mean that you will see these patients and you will see them more and more as the prescription rate increases. To be honest, as you just said, Anna, it's most of the ARIA are asymptomatic, but 1% of treated patients with ATT will develop severe ARIA E or H. That's what we know from the randomized clinical trial. At the moment, it's about 1% across all the phase 3 trials. So 1% can appear small at first, but when you realize that thousands, hundreds of thousands of patients that can theoretically benefit from these drugs, then there will be hundreds and thousands of patients with severe ARIA. So you will probably have, you will probably see this patient at least once in your lifetime. That's one of the key messages. So you will see this patient with Alzheimer's, and you will see them coming with a severe ARIA. So it you will have to keep that in mind in your differentials. Nonetheless, and that's another key message, the ARIA rate is the highest during the first 12 months of the treatment, depending on the antibody and the titration protocol. But it's about 1 year. So, and after that, it decreases. So you will mostly them during the first month of titration with either lecanemab or donanemab or whichever drug will be approved in the future. And then this this will decrease. So that's also an important message. A patient who will be under ATT but for a long time has a much lower chance to develop ARIA than at the beginning.
Let's now discuss the concurrent use of antithrombotic therapy in patients that are receiving anti-amyloid therapies. As far as clinical trial experience, in the EMERGE and ENGAGE trials of aducanumab, antiplatelet or anticoagulants were excluded from use, so we don't have any useful information. In terms of the Clarity AD study, antithrombotic use was permitted, and antithrombotic medications were not associated with increased risk of ARIA. However, there are 3 deaths in the open label extension of the trial, which were associated with the use of either anticoagulants or acute thrombolytics. And as far as the Trailblazer ALZ-2 study, the phase 3 clinical trial of donanemab, in this trial, antithrombotic use was also permitted. Antithrombotic medications were not associated with an increased risk of ARIA. And although there were 3 deaths from intracranial hemorrhage, none of these patients wore anticoagulant therapy. Dr. Villain, do you have any thoughts on this you would like to share with us?
Absolutely. I think one of the key messages from the Clarity AD trial is indeed there is no increased risk of ARIA associated with antithrombotic medication, but there is an increased severity of ARIA associated with antithrombotic medication. So the patient who would have done a mild hemorrhagic ARIA without a anticoagulant will then do a moderate or severe hemorrhagic ARIA if he is under ATT. That's why the appropriate use recommendation that was proposed by American authors this year by Jeffrey Cummings proposed cautious in the use of anticoagulants and most of all with lytics in this patient, because you have an increased risk when you have an ARIA H of hemorrhage, and of course if you are under anticoagulant or lytics you will increase the severity of this hemorrhage. That seems to me a reasonable approach, even if at the moment we don't have much more details regarding the donanemab trial on this, and the preliminary data seems to be a little bit contradictory with the lecanemab data in this regard, since it was not associated with an increased severity or rate of ARIA. But at the moment, the one who has FDA approval is lecanemab, and we have clearly an increased risk of ARIA severity with this drug, so we should be cautious when it's prescribed in a patient under anticoagulant.
So let's discuss now the necessary MRI sequences when assessing patients for ARIA. There has been a lot of debate on the optimal sequences to use, both in various radiology societies, but also at my own institution as part of the Dementia Steering Committee. I think the key message to take home is every time you have one of these patients on anti-amyloid therapy presenting with suspicious symptoms that may represent ARIA, there are 3 sequences you need to obtain. You need to obtain a DWI to exclude an acute infarct. You need a flare, either 2D or 3D, to assess for ARIA-E. and you need a heme-sensitive sequence such as GRE or SWI or SWAN to assess for ARIA-H. At my institution, we are being very conservative in our approach, and we want to detect all possible cases of ARIA. Therefore, we will be using the more sensitive 3D T2 flare and the more sensitive susceptibility weighted imaging or SWI, and all patients will be scanned on a 3 Tesla scanner. But again, especially in the acute emergency room setting, every patient needs 3 sequences: DWI, flare, and a heme sensitive sequence such as GRE or SWI. As you can imagine, the detection of ARIA-E and ARIA-H in the clinical setting depends a lot not only on the MRI sequences that are used, but also on the experience of the interpreting radiologist. So in light of this, there's a lot of interest in potential AI tools that may help us better detect both ARIA-E and ARIA-H. None of these tools are yet FDA approved, but some are undergoing regulatory consideration at this time. And here I have examples of both ARIA-E and ARIA-H template reports that may assist us one day in the clinical setting and help us improve our accuracy in detecting these pathologies. So here we have our first example. And then on the next slide, we have another example, again, for both ARIA-E and ARIA-H. These AI-assisted tools will compare to prior scans and also classify the severity of findings on MR imaging. And now to conclude our discussion, I would just like to highlight the importance of a collaboration and team effort in detecting and managing ARIA in the emergency department. So in the center, of course, we have our patient. And then in addition to the emergency medicine physician, you have your neuroradiologist to consult on the imaging findings. You have experts such as Dr. Villan in neurology and neurosurgery to help with put the clinical picture into context. We have the patient general practitioner or primary care physician that really knows them best and can provide invaluable history. And we have the pharmacist who can help arrive at appropriate treatments for the underlying process.
So now let's revisit the ARS question we asked at the beginning of this program. This was an excellent program today, and thank you, Dr. Franceschi, for your excellent discussion. Let's summarize our discussion with our SMART goals: specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. That is what I hope that you will take from this presentation to apply to your practice. So first of all, identify patient-related risk factors, timing of occurrence of ARIA like MRI or clinical symptoms, and the presence of ATT to facilitate a timely diagnosis of ARIA. Recognize ARIA-E and ARIA-H mimics so that an appropriate team-based approach that includes a knowledgeable neuroradiologist like Dr. Franceschi can most accurately and rapidly diagnose and manage ARIA for patients who are on ATTs. Today's CMEO briefcase is part of a three-part series of care-based activities that can be found on the Alzheimer's Disease Hub. I hope you'll check out the other two activities in the series. The Alzheimer's Disease Hub has these activities and many others on AD and MORS. And the CME Outfitters Alzheimer's Hub also has a number of excellent resources to share with your patients. Thank you again, Dr. Franceschi, and thank you to our audience for joining us.